Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. The FBI is warning of plans for armed protests at all 50 state capitals and in Washington, D.C. in the days leading up to Joe Biden's inauguration next Wednesday. The Pentagon says at least 15,000 National Guard troops will be deployed to D.C. by this Saturday. Law enforcement agencies are also ramping up security at the state level. The Michigan State Capitol Commission has banned the open carry of firearms inside the state's Capitol building, and Washington, D.C. Mayor Muriel Bowser is asking people to avoid the city during Biden's inauguration. On Tuesday, the FBI and DOJ finally held a news conference about last week's deadly insurrection. The DOJ said they're pursuing at least 150 suspects who attended the riot. Many have already been arrested. Some were off-duty police officers, members of the military, and firefighters. U.S. Acting Attorney for the District of Columbia, Michael Sherwin, said people are going to be shocked with all of the stories that are still going to come out. Well, a new investigation by ProPublica and Frontline exposes members of several far-right hate groups, including the Proud Boys and others with violent ideologies who were identified at the riot. Videos reveal the presence of several hardcore nativists and white nationalists who also participated in the 2017 White Power Rally in Charlottesville, Virginia. According to several outlets, far-right extremists are now using fringe messaging boards and other encrypted communication apps to plan more violence on January 20th. Joining us to talk about all of this is Will Carlis, a national correspondent for USA Today based in San Diego. Will covers extremism and emerging issues nationwide, and you can find the piece that Will recently wrote called Armed Militias Are Illegal, Will Authorities Finally Crack Down If They Show Up at State Capitals Next Week, at yourcallradio.org. Hi, Will. Thanks so much for joining us again.
Hey, thanks for having me on again.
Well, it's great to have you, Will. It's been just over a week since last week's insurrection happened. Given that you cover these issues so closely, what really stands out for you now that we're learning a lot more about what happened, but there are still outstanding questions?
I don't think that the news that has come out is particularly new to a lot of the people who both study these groups and who were there on the day. I mean, there was very clearly a contingent of people from all of these various different extremist groups. They had said they were going to be there. They were there. They weren't necessarily advertising themselves in the ways that they had previously, in terms of like wearing insignia and wearing sort of trademark costumes. But I think that the ProPublica has done a fantastic job in kind of looking at the photographs and identifying these people for who they are. But I think it's the usual suspects, the usual crowd that we expected would be there and who have been kind of the agitators for the last few years.
And for people who don't follow these groups as closely as you do, what do people need to know about this? Because one theme that's coming out in social media is that in many media outlets, we have been subjected to these stories about the Trump voter. Let's go to a diner and talk to Trump voters. Let's talk to the disaffected mm-hmm. Trump voter who no longer has a job. And a lot of people are saying, okay, well, this really does blow up that theory, because these people were organized. They had to have money to go to D.C., to stay in hotels. What are your thoughts about that?
Well, first of all, those lucky people who don't have to follow these groups as a living, I envy them very much. I think there's truth to kind of both ideas. I think that what we saw last week was certainly a core group of what I would almost call professional agitators. They're people who in some cases, make a living off selling things like merchandise online. I mean, a good example is the leader of the Proud Boys, Enrique Tarrio. I mean, he makes his living, such as it is, selling merchandise on a website, merchandise kind of related to the Proud Boys and related to his political cause. You've also got people like podcasters and kind of professional provocateurs who make a living off selling advertising through, you know, channels like YouTube. So there's certainly that group of core people. Now, I don't want to discount the fact that the vast majority of people who were in DC last week were not those people. They were the Trump supporters who you meet in diners in small towns or in big cities. I mean, they were regular Trump supporters. So I would say my estimate is that for every kind of person that stormed up around the Capitol building and into the Capitol building, there were another 9 or 10 people who were protesting angrily and in some cases, you know, violently, but also peacefully. I mean, there were a lot of people in DC last Wednesday, and an awful lot of them were middle-aged people, families, elderly people, you know, run-of-the-mill Trump supporters who are there to give their support to the president. And I think that that's been a little bit lost. I don't want to take away from the violence and the seriousness of what happened last Wednesday. It was an extraordinary and historic event. But certainly that doesn't represent every single person who was in the Capitol last week.
Will Carlos is a national correspondent for USA Today, and now I'd like to welcome A.C. Thompson to the show. A.C. is a staff reporter with ProPublica, who often covers the criminal justice system. He has worked as a producer and correspondent for Frontline, and his latest investigation and collaboration with Frontline is called Members of Several Well-Known Hate Groups Identified at Capitol Riot, and you can find that at yourcallradio.org. Hi, A.C. Thanks so much for joining us again.
Thanks, Rose.
Well, given that you also deeply cover these groups, AC, we're learning a lot more about what happened last week. What really stands out for you?
You know, I think to me, a thing that's so interesting is that throughout 2020, from January 2020 to January 2021, like almost exactly 12 months, we saw this rising interest in targeting government buildings from sort of extremist groups. So in January 2020, we had 20,000 armed people descend on the Virginia State Capitol. Later, we had armed Boogaloo and militia members storm the Capitol in Michigan. We had capitals that had protesters come into them in Idaho, in Oregon. And, you know, we had in Olympia, Washington, we had protests in front of the State House there, and two people in 2 weeks were shot. So I think all of that is sort of a rising wave of targeting towards these government buildings. And beyond that, we had, you know, the plot to kidnap Governor Gretchen Whitmer. We had many, many threats directed at elections officials, public health officials, elected leaders. And I think that has been the sort of story of the past 12 months, is this rising anger and extremism towards government.
What about, you know, how do you think we should talk about these people, AC? Because, you know, Will was just addressing this earlier, that they come from different backgrounds, factions. I mean, what are your thoughts about this, AC? I've just been thinking about the show we did earlier this week, and one of our guests said that his wife is a Black doctor, and in some forums with other doctors, she's learning that other Black doctors are members of the Proud Boys. And a lot of people actually emailed us about this and wanted to know more. So what are your thoughts about how we should actually talk about these people?
Well, I think one thing to do is to think that there's a sort of broad tent of MAGA, Make America Great Again supporters, and that big tent, that broad spectrum, includes people who may be avowed white supremacists and neo-Nazis, and there were some of those that were present. It includes conspiracy theorists, includes militia members. It includes groups like the Proud Boys, who I wouldn't describe as an explicitly racist group, but would describe more as an ultra-nationalist sort of street fighting outfit, or a nativist street fighting outfit. And so there's a big range. There's also people who, you know, you can't put any of those labels on, but they are deeply devoted to Donald Trump. And as Will indicated, there are people that came to DC expecting a rally and a protest, and they were not the people that built the gallows in front of the Capitol. And you can't really even lump them in any of those other categories that I mentioned.
What are your thoughts, Will? Did we drop Will?
Sorry, no, I was muted.
Okay, go ahead.
Yeah, it's complicated. I mean, it's, you know, 2021 is complicated. I mean, I think AC's, you know, right on the money is that, look, I mean, I'm not going to be very popular for saying this, but I think that one of the big problems that we have in this country is the terminology that we're using and the way that we're thinking about these groups. I think there's a tendency on the part of the media and on the public as a whole to look at these people who were in the Capitol last week and to label them usually like with some convenient term like white supremacists. You know, like whites, we all know who white supremacists are. They've been around since the birth of the Union. They've always been a problem. They're certainly very much out there and certainly very much a force. And it's sort of an easily graspable bogeyman that people can say that's who these people are. I don't think that's who most of these people are. And I'd be interested to hear AC's thoughts. I think that there are certainly white supremacists in amongst these crowds. But I think that the majority of the people who were there last week are driven by their own mishmash of politics and primarily by conspiracy theories. You saw people there who were driven to extremes by this, by the QAnon conspiracy theory. There are people there who are driven by conspiracy theories about cultural Marxism and that America is going to turn into a communist state. And, you know, most of the people that you talk to at these rallies believe that they are doing good. They believe that they're the right people who are going to save America. And, you know, by and large, when you talk to neo-Nazis, when you talk to white supremacists, like, they don't really think that. They kind of know that they're the bad guys and that they're kind of wrong, but they don't care because they are hateful, horrible people who have their twisted worldview. That's not how I would categorize most of the people who were there last week. I think that they're people who believe that they're on a mission, in many cases a mission from God, to save America from various different evils. I'd be really interested to hear what AC thinks, but that's kind of the conclusion that I've come to after years of following these movements and particularly looking at the moment we're at today.
AC, what are your thoughts?
You know, and Will and I have talked about this before. I think one of the things that we're seeing now is a sort of coalescing of what you could call a multi-ethnic or a multicultural fascist sort of movement or authoritarian movement. And so when you see people in the streets who are wearing shirts that say right-wing death squad, or they say Pinochet did nothing wrong or something of this nature, they're clearly embracing fascist messaging and iconography. And part of that is just to offend people and to be obnoxious. And then I think a lot of that is actually pretty deeply held. And so I think like what the sort of focus for a lot of hardcore right-wing activists has shifted from a intense fixation on race to an intense fixation on the sort of issues that Will was talking about. And the scapegoat now, the other now, becomes not necessarily people of color, but I think you see the scapegoating being around so-called socialists. You know, basically anybody to the left of Donald Trump is a socialist, a communist, around so-called globalists, around people who are trying to deal with the pandemic and get the pandemic under control, and perhaps telling people that they can't open their business because of that or that they need to wear a mask. I think the scapegoats are people who are out there in the streets protesting for racial justice and protesting for police accountability. And so I think those are the sort of targets at this point. And you see this sort of very hardcore right-wing movement, but it has, the fixation on race has diminished to a certain extent. And like Will said, I think what I'm talking about is a portion of the people who are out there, not all of the people.
Right. You know, the other question that came up on our show about fascism is how could you have a guy, Aaron Mostofsky, who is the Jewish son of a Brooklyn judge? He was taken into custody in Brooklyn on Tuesday. He faces four federal charges, including theft of government property, stand in the same crowd as a guy that wears a Camp Auschwitz sweatshirt. Now, we got a number of emails about that. What are your thoughts on that, AC? I mean, that's just one example.
So, you know, I just interviewed yesterday a guy who's a Proud Boy leader, and he was in Charlottesville, which I was as well. And he was there with, as what he would call himself, a civic nationalist. So he has very, very hard right views, very hard right views. But he would say, I was once a Klansman. I was once a Nazi skinhead. I'm not anymore. And I was marching there in Charlottesville, even though there were Nazis and white supremacists there, for my agenda, which is a very hard right, but not necessarily explicitly racist or not racist agenda. I think you had the same thing in at the Capitol. I think you've had the same thing throughout the past several years, where at times you see the sort of groups that I singled out. And I think extremist is probably the best overarching label there, that are the sort of white nationalist types who will at times rub shoulders with people who are not necessarily white nationalists, but maybe don't mind being in the same crowd.
Hmm. Will, what would you add?
I think that's very well put. I mean, I think that you know, the young man who you just mentioned is a good example of the fact that this is complicated. You know, it's not, these aren't a monolithic, homogenous group of people. I mean, I would also add that, you know, last Wednesday, there were an awfully large number of non-white people in the crowds. I mean, there was a huge contingent of Chinese Americans for Trump, for example. Mm. There were African Americans in the crowd. There were Latino Americans in the crowd. So, you know, the idea that this is sort of a monolithic group, I think, is something we need to, you know, recognize and get away from. I will say that, you know, none of this is to discount the fact that there is a real thread of anti-Semitism and white supremacism that runs through these crowds. And to the extent that maybe perhaps not all of these people believe these ideas, I do think that it's very true and very dangerous that the people who really do believe these things, the true sort of neo-Nazis and white supremacists and anti-Semites out there, see this crowd as their recruitment ground. They see they see these people who are susceptible to believing, you know, conspiracy theories that most educated people would never give the light of day, as the next recruits for their worldview. So while it's very easy to sort of look at them and say, well, most of these people are white supremacists, and therefore, you know, maybe they're not as kind of as bad as the extremists that we've seen historically, there's an awful lot of potential white supremacists, potential neo-Nazis out there. And that's been particularly interesting to watch in the last few days, as Parler has been taken, as the social media site Parler, where a lot of these people congregated, has been taken down. A lot of these people have flooded into Telegram, an encrypted messaging service, where they're being confronted. The sort of what I would call the kind of more mainstream MAGA crowd are now being confronted with the kind of hardcore neo-Nazis and white supremacists on these channels. And you're now seeing sort of Trump supporters who've come to these channels kind of being spoon-fed, you know, go read this manifesto, go read this, go read that. And you've kind of almost been able to witness it. People who monitor this have been able to almost witness this kind of greater extremism and greater radicalization in real time. And it's very disturbing and scary to watch.
Will Carlos is a national correspondent for USA Today, and AC Thompson is a staff reporter with ProPublica. We cannot take calls today, but you can email us if you have a comment or a question for our guests. You can also tweet us at Your Call Radio. The email is yourcall@kalw.org. Again, we cannot take calls today, but we can take your emails, yourcall@kalw.org. You can also tweet us at Your Call Radio. Will, can you talk to us about how people become radicalized in the first place? And again, that's a broad term because people have views about all sorts of things. But how do people get caught up in these groups and have these views?
Mm-hmm. I think ultimately the kind of uniting force is I think if there's anything that unites this crowd, it's sort of a disbelief in facts and a disbelief in what most of us consider to be reality. It's a deep distrust of the news media. It's a deep distrust of academia and the government. And it's a sort of a concept that the real truth is out there somewhere else and it's being hidden from you, and that everybody else is stupid and you're the only person that can, or you and your fellow believers are the only people who really truly understand the way that the world is. And so and that to a certain extent has always been the case. I mean, that's how you know, back in the 1980s, I mean, neo-Nazis would recruit people, but with exactly those ideas, you know, that the world is secretly being run by a cabal of, you know, of powerful Jewish people. I mean, that's, you know, there are echoes of that in the QAnon conspiracy theory. But I think ultimately that's how radicalization starts, at the point where somebody, you know, throws away their belief in facts. They throw away their belief in what most people believe. You know, there's a term for it. I mean, these guys, they call it alternatively red pilling. You know, you take the red pill and then you suddenly everything becomes clear and you can understand the world in a way that nobody else can understand. I think that's the gateway. Now, from that point on, there's all sorts of different ways and people go down all sorts of different paths. But that's I think that's the way that people end up on that slippery slope.
AC, what would you add? And can you also talk about whether or not you think this is growing? Because what's been really sad for me is to see on social media that people are actually losing their family members to a lot of these groups and QAnon, for example. I mean, like, people are saying, I don't know how to get my brother back. We lost our dad to this group. Is it growing?
Yeah, I think there's, like, Will made good points, and the question about sort of QAnon essentially mentally abducting people's family members is a good one. I sort of see several different issues here. And one is that in the time of the pandemic, people are just simply spending more time online. And when you talk to people like Cynthia Miller Idris Miller at American, she'll tell you at American University, like, look, when people just spend a lot of time online, when they spend hour after hour after hour, it's easier for them to become consumed by this unreality and to slip into this hole of radicalization. I think that is a real issue, you know, that they see this process happening much faster as people are more and more online, particularly in these disconnected days. I think another thing that you see when I talk to members of these groups, they legitimately seem to not be able to distinguish what is a verifiable fact from what is conjecture. And they then sort of throw up their hands and say, there's all this information. I'm getting it from social media. I see all these news sites. I get information from podcasts. I don't know what to make of it. And the only thing that I can do is then decide that I'm going to subscribe to a particular worldview that seems to resonate with me, that may be promulgated by a conspiracy theorist, maybe promulgated by a Boogaloo boy leader, maybe totally nuts. And they will then say, this is what I can live with. This was, makes sense to me. So that's another thing. And I think a third thing is, you know, having been at a bunch of these Trump election rallies and a bunch of the Stop the Steal rallies, I have met a lot of people who come from very desperate parts of this country, who frankly tend to be white working class people, who say, you know, I used to be a Democrat. I used to read the New York Times online. I used to watch CNN, but I feel like the Democrats have abandoned me and my community, and the factories have left and my job went overseas. And this was the first guy who was talking about issues that matter in the Rust Belt. And so I have a deep, intense connection to him. Mm-hmm. And what he says, I believe, and they are willing to follow him in somewhat like a cult leader.
Wow. Will, I know we have to let you go. Do you have anything to add on that important point that AC just made?
I think that the analogy of Trumpism as a cult is a very, very good one. I don't think we've seen the last of it. I mean, he may be leaving the White House, but I don't think we've seen the last of the Trump and the MAGA movement. I think there's a huge number of people who are dissatisfied and angry in this country, and they're going to continue looking for a leader, and they're going to continue looking for another way. But I will leave you in the very capable hands of AC. We've been covering this together for a long time, and he's one of the best out there. So sorry I couldn't be with you for longer.
Then thank you so much for your time, Will, and thanks for your reporting.
Thank you.
Will Carlos is a national correspondent for USA Today covering extremism and emerging issues nationwide, and you can find his recent piece at yourcallradio.org. Coming up after a break, AC Thompson will stay with us, staff reporter with ProPublica. And again, we cannot take your phone calls today, but you can email us yourcall@kalw.org or tweet at yourcallradio. We'll be back after this. This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Today, we are talking about what we are learning about last week's insurrection. There are a lot of questions we still have, but according to today's guest, A.C. Thompson, and the reporting that he and his team have done, we do have information about a number of the people who were at last week's riots. Many are well-known members of various hate groups who also participated in the 2017 White Power Rally in Charlottesville, Virginia. I should also say, AC, a number of women on social media who work at various clinics across the country say that they have also recognized a number of the men at last week's riot who have been pretty violent in front of clinics that provide abortions.
Yeah, that's the thing that's so interesting now, and I think it's a thing we see change since Charlottesville, people in the wake of Charlottesville and the really intense reaction to the murder of Heather Heyer and the attack on protesters there and what we saw there, social media and people using social media realized like, oh, we can identify these people from our communities. We can figure out who they are. A lot of these people are out there with unmasked and running around at these events. And now fast forward 3+ years and all over the country, people are trying to, are looking online, they're looking at videos or looking at photos and saying, hey, this is the person that I see down the street. This is the police officer from Oakland, or this is whoever. I think we're gonna hear a lot about a lot of different threats, whether it's the anti-abortion current, whether it is the people who have served in the military or currently serving in the military and took part in the events, whether it's people who are associated with movements that are just now starting to creep out into the light. So I think it's pretty interesting what's happening.
We have an email from James who says, how can these right-wing radicals be brought in from the cold? It almost seems impossible to talk to them.
That's such a good question. And I've been thinking about that a lot, you know, and like I said, I've been interviewing people in this movement, and there are things that I notice. And one thing that I notice is that a lot of these men, and they are predominantly men, and most of the guys I meet are white men, have a lot of the same concerns and issues and grievances as people that they would say are on the left or that they perceive to be on the left. And a lot of people in communities of color. So yesterday I was talking to a guy who's a very hard right activist, and he was raising all these concerns about police accountability and about police abuse. I said, you sound like a BLM activist. You sound like a Black Lives Matter activist. And he said, yeah, but they're crazy leftists and they're Marxist and socialist. I said, but yeah, if you sat down in a room with them, I bet you would realize that you have a lot of things in common, and that this sort of overlying binary construct of left and right that people are wedded to, that it doesn't always make sense. So I honestly am hopeful for dialogue between people. And I'm hopeful, like Pete Seamy, who's the sociologist of the white power movement and a real good thinker on this stuff. He was the one who told me, he said years ago, he said, these people are not irredeemable. They are not totally lost. And he had watched many men leave these movements and de-radicalize and get involved in really meaningful, important work and leave hate behind. And so I think it's totally possible, but we need to start those conversations.
Sally wants to know, you know, can you talk more about the sexism in these groups?
Yeah, that's a great question. You know, for the Proud Boys, they had a sort of spinoff outfit that was started by a woman that wanted to call themselves the Proud Girls. And they responded in incredibly misogynistic and vitriolic terms about that, saying they didn't want any of that. And I will tell you, the misogyny, this sort of sense that we are the men who are defending traditional gender roles in America is a big part of a lot of these movements. And it's a thing that I think you can see go from militia movements to the Proud Boys to the white nationalists to sometimes just the average MAGA folks. And I think that is a pretty big thing. And in some ways, you're seeing a reaction to changing values and changing conventions in society. And so part of what you're getting from the people that show up at a Stop the Steal rally or at a MAGA rally is this resistance to sort of changing norms in America around gender, around many issues.
Have you interviewed many of the women involved in these movements? I mean, based on the videos that have been widely released, it looks like it's like 95% male, but there were women also at last week's riot.
So I've seen it change some. So in Charlottesville, which was pretty dominated, was absolutely dominated by the overtly white supremacist groups, there were almost no women there. At the more radical edge of the MAGA events in the last couple of years, you've seen more women participating and more women coming in from sort of the mainstream Republican world into and then rubbing shoulders with the sort of more extreme elements. But I have not interviewed very many women, and that is because I have just encountered fewer. Hmm.
You know, talking about women, I was just thinking about the two members of Congress who are supporters of QAnon, Marjorie Taylor Greene of Georgia and Lauren Boebert of Colorado. Both are major supporters of Trump overturning the election results. It's pretty shocking to think that people like this are now politicians. Marjorie Taylor Greene says she's going to introduce articles of impeachment against Biden on January 21st. What are your thoughts about this? And are these two in constant or regular communication with these groups? Do you know?
I don't know about the level of communication or coordination between the fringe and extremist groups and some of these GOP figures. I think it's absolutely disturbing and very worrisome to see this adoption of these conspiracy theories and this fixation on this really like darkly magical thinking, this crazy thinking, right? It's super worrisome. I'll tell you, when I have been reading these social media channels and sort of social media feeds of the extremist groups and the definitely like sort of fringe groups, I don't know that they're that fringe anymore, because the messages that they're putting out sound a lot of times like mainstream GOP talking points. So if you were to follow the Parler channel of the American Guard, which is a very hard right ultra-nationalist outfit that has been present at a lot of these protests over in recent weeks, you know, the sort of stuff that's coming out is like, COVID is a hoax. The election has been stolen. There's a cabal of globalists who are trying to take over the world. And Trump is our leader and democracy is being stolen from us by a band of socialists led by Joe Biden. Well, that is actually not that out of the norm for sort of GOP talking points and sort of mainstream Republican talking points these days. This sort of fringe and the mainstream, I think, have converged.
What are your thoughts about what politicians are saying about, you know, whether or not this was helped by members of Congress? Because we're learning that these rioters found offices in the Capitol that are very hard to find, or are in some cases did not have labels on them. For example, Representative Clyburn works in an office that's away from his, quote, official office with his name tag on it, and they found the office that he works in. And so what are your thoughts about what we are learning about maybe a connection between the rioters and members of Congress? In fact, Stop the Steal organizer Ali Alexander said that he was getting help from three members of Congress, Representatives Paul Gosar, Andy Biggs, and Mo Brooks.
Right. And you know, Paul Gosar in particular has been a real proponent of very extreme concepts and conspiracy theories and so forth. And I think that that's going to be one of the things that really has to be explored in great depth, is what sort of possible collaboration was there between members of Congress and the sort of insurrectionists. And that is going to be a key thing going forward, that we have a few facts now. The Ali Alexander statement on it was quite interesting, but we don't know enough yet. And that's going to be something that has to be explored in great detail. I think another thing that's key, and people have discussed this, I interviewed Rep. Andre Carson from the Indianapolis area, who's a Democratic House member who is African-American. And he said, you know, to me, some of what I saw there reminded me of a Klan rally and reminded me of some of the hate groups that have coalesced and gotten together in Indiana, where I'm from. And he said, I have a concern that there were sympathizers and empathizers within the Capitol Police and within the ranks of law enforcement. That's part of why things got so out of hand so quickly and so violent so quickly. And I think we've all been exploring that question over the last week, you know, of what sort of possible collaboration was there on the part of Capitol Police, because there are all those videos out there that are really concerning, that seem to show sympathy, if not support, for these insurrectionists.
Right. Yeah. And we talked about this when we did a special show last night, but there was a great piece at BuzzFeed about how Black Capitol Police officers were basically left to fend for themselves amidst this overwhelmingly majority white mob. And they dealt with the N-word, horrific levels of racism. One man said that he actually was just crying in the Capitol for 15 minutes because it was all so overwhelming.
Right, right. And when we've been speaking to Capitol Police, they are shaken. They are absolutely shaken. You know, and they've had a colleague who apparently was beaten to death. They've had a colleague who committed suicide, and they were subjected to a really incredibly scary and bloody thing. I think that's another dynamic that hasn't really been explored here that to me is fascinating and concerning. And it's that you had the people who were the back the blue people. You had the right wing groups and activists who were like, we're pro-police. We are absolutely pro-police. And I had been at these earlier marches in DC in recent months where you would see these groups get right up to the line of fighting with the police. And then they would say, nope, we're not going to do that. We're the pro-law enforcement group. That's changed. That's absolutely changed. And I think what you see from a lot of them now is we are going to war with the police. We are going to war with the government. We may even go to war with the GOP because we don't feel like they're standing behind us. And so I think you've seen a real mental shift among a lot of those activists.
And that says so much, AC, about what we now call white privilege, that they thought they could just show up, smile for the camera, go live on all of these platforms, not even wear a mask. I mean, COVID, that was absolutely horrific that they weren't masked, but they didn't even mask their identities. And they just assumed that they could get away with this and the police would be on their side. But once they saw that that wasn't the case with some of the police, I heard video of them saying, F the blue.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. That's exactly what I'm talking about. And, you know, this is the sort of conspiratorial thinking that Will was hitting on, where these people who are part of these protests will post online and they'll say, you know, the police are in bed with the Reds and that's why they are now looking to arrest us. And like, what does that mean? That's crazy talk. That's there are... you know, but that's the sort of mentality. And the mentality now is we have nothing to lose. We will go to war with the police. Yeah.
AC Thompson is a staff reporter with ProPublica, and you could read his latest investigation at yourcallradio.org. We are not taking phone calls today, but you can email us yourcall@kalw.org or tweet us at yourcallradio. We have a comment from Sue, who writes, yesterday I was thinking about how a number of years ago we had the extreme right Tea Party group, and now we have these various other groups coming to the fore and some government reps who share those beliefs. So I wonder if they will have staying power in our government.
The question was, will they have staying power in our government?
And I think growing, because when you look at the Tea Party, it started small, and then all of a sudden you got the Freedom Caucus, and all of a sudden Paul Ryan and John Boehner were not conservative enough. I mean, these are very conservative guys, and yet they were kind of pushed out by this new faction.
Yeah, I think that's a great point. In a lot of ways that you can see the Tea Party as a predecessor movement to the sort of MAGA movement that has developed. And I think that's a really important point. And the Tea Party ideology was like the MAGA ideology, incoherent. There was not really an ideology, but in a lot of ways, what it was a vehicle for white identity and white grievance. And I think a lot of people who study right-wing movements and right-wing politics will say that's an early point where we start seeing a new wave of sort of white working class populism pushing forward in the Democratic or in the Republican Party and sort of remaking the Republican Party. And, you know, that's when you get Sarah Palin talking about the real Americans, quote unquote, who live in the suburbs or out in the country, suggesting that those of us who live in large cities are not real Americans.
Right. Well, and also, you know, thinking about the media's role in all of this, AC, as someone who focuses on these groups and really dives deep, how much attention do you think we should be spending on this? I mean, is all of this media attention also acting as a recruiting tool?
It is a fine line to walk. And I think that's a super good question. When I've interviewed Proud Boys leaders recently, they have said the biggest recruiting tool we ever had was Donald Trump discussing us at the presidential debate, at the first presidential debate of this campaign cycle. They said we got hundreds and hundreds of emails after that from people wanting to join. That was an advertisement, and it was meant to be a critical question about the group. And it ended up being an advertising bulletin that was incredible. And for me as a journalist, I constantly have this problem of, are we overhyping a threat? Are we giving a platform to people who should not have it? Are we discussing something and thereby making it appealing to young men who are looking for something in their life and are somewhat lost? And I think that's a constant conversation that myself and my team and my bosses at Frontline and ProPublica are always having. And let's say this, you know, the reason I've thought at times it was important to interview members of these movements and get their own words and get their perspective in their own words is because I think at times they describe what they believe and what their issues are in a way that is important to hear, you know, and that I can paraphrase it and my team can sort of talk about what these guys believe. But if somebody tells you, you know, they're pretty extreme beliefs, I think sometimes that's more impactful and more important.
What are your thoughts about going forward? I mean, you know, we've been subjected, like I said, to so many stories about Trump supporters, many broadcast outlets just allow them to spread lies. I mean, just the silly, ridiculous lies about socialists, and it just doesn't, you know. But the serious ones, for example, you know, over the last year, there's been this whole sort of pro-police, anti-police frame in the media with defund the police, and the way that it's been covered has been fairly simplistic in many outlets. Well, now that you have a lot of these guys saying F the blue, there's video of these guys actually pulling a cop down the stairs and beating him up. As you said, one cop was killed. What are your thoughts about this now moving forward, how this issue should be covered?
Yeah, as far as the coverage goes, I think that we're going to have to do this. We're going to have to be smart as journalists. We're going to have to be vigilant, but we don't also want to be paranoid. And I think there is absolutely a role for true journalism and even legacy media to play in informing the public. I think a world like when I meet a lot of people in social movements, be they left or right, they're sort of animated by a world of Facebook posts, tweets, YouTube videos, and very condensed opinion that they're getting online. And I think actually doing fact-based journalism and sharing that has an important value for everyone. The thing I think to be concerned about as an ongoing threat is that you had tens of millions of people who voted for Donald Trump. When I talked to them, they would say, look, the only way Trump will not retain office is if there is a conspiracy, if there is fraud, if there is voting irregularities and corruption. And many of them believe that to be the case now. If you look at the polling, many of them believe the election was stolen. And that is a message that the media has helped Trump broadcast over and over and over again. So the notion that someone would act dramatically and violently if they truly believe that the election was stolen, well, of course they will. Like, that's just to be expected. So we have months and months of vigilance as a nation and as law enforcement and as journalists to you know, be aware that there could be a serious violent attack on this country from within this country.
How concerned are you about the next week, given that there have been threats? You describe one person who goes by the handle Colonel007, who posted on Parler, "Many of us will return on January 19th carrying our weapons. We will come in numbers that no standing army or police agency can match." So how concerned are you based on what you've read?
I'm very concerned. And, I want to temper that. I want to temper my concern by not getting too paranoid and too freaked out. But I think we have to be concerned. And I think the concern is not just this week. Like, we're going to start seeing protests, big protests possibly tomorrow around the country, and that are likely to extend through the inauguration. And, you know, hopefully those will not turn violent. We will not see a mass casualty event. But I think we need to be alert for a mass casualty event or a serious violent action for at least the next year.
Mm.
After Barack Obama was elected as the first Black president of this country, we saw a massive uptick in anti-government and white power activity. And I'm afraid we're, you know, going to see the same sort of thing happen during the early months of the Joe Biden administration.
And the sad thing is, AC, and we're almost out of time, the show just flew by. You know, unfortunately, all it takes is one person with an AR. I mean, I hate saying this, but this is a fact. It takes one person who can kill a lot of people in just seconds.
Right, exactly. Like, that's a key point, is that in America, we have made it very easy for somebody without a lot of training and without a lot of money to do horrible harm to this country very, very quickly.
And the question is, how should this be addressed without the further repression of free speech and the right to protest?
Yeah. And I think there was a good point that y'all made earlier, which is that people should be able to go to the Capitol and protest. And people who went to the Capitol and did not engage in violence or property destruction, like, that was their First Amendment right. And that should be supported and should be appreciated, even if I think the grounds for the protest are crazy and farcical. Mm-hmm. But that it will be a thing, too, is, you know, with all the talk of stepping up domestic terrorism statute or creating a domestic terrorism statute and stepping up policing of domestic terrorism, that we don't allow legitimate, peaceful, and even edgy protest to be suppressed improperly.
Well, AC, thank you so much, as always, for your reporting, and thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Rose.
AC Thompson is a staff reporter with ProPublica. He's also a producer and correspondent for Frontline, and you can check out his latest investigation. Members of several well-known hate groups identified at Capitol Riot at yourcallradio.org. Coming up on our media roundtable tomorrow, we will continue this conversation with a focus on the rioters who went after the news media. They etched "Murder the Media" into a door of the Capitol. They punched an AP photographer, threatened journalists, and damaged or stole their equipment. So we will talk about that tomorrow, and then we'll talk about the COVID pandemic in England, where more than 84,000 people have died. Thanks to Leah Cesarine for producing today's show. Thanks to Joanne Marr for keeping our studio running. And thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call.